This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. It's been 1 year now since Katrina, 5 years since September 11th and the anthrax attacks that followed. Are we ready for the next public health emergency? On the program today, we're going to take a look at what we've learned and size up our current situation. Two guests join us this afternoon. They are David Rosner of Columbia University and Gerald Markowitz of John Jay College. They are the co-authors of numerous articles and books, including Are We Ready? Public Health Since 9/11. In this book, the authors, both historians, provide readers with lessons learned from September 11th. They have sought out the people who responded to the attacks. They've examined the response to September 11th at the federal, state, and local level, as well as looked at the interaction between those levels of government. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guests. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guests. David Rosner is professor of public health and history at Columbia University and co-director of the Center for the History and Ethics of Public Health at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Gerald Markowitz is distinguished professor of history at John Jay College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Are We Ready? Public Health Since 9/11 is published by the University of California Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Professor Rosner, Professor Markowitz, welcome. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Nice to be here. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. To begin, it might be helpful to talk about what this term public health means. What does it encompass? Who wants to take that?
Well, maybe should I start, Jerry?
Sure. Okay. Sure, David.
Basically, public health is everything that keeps us healthy, and it's a field that encompasses many different disciplines and many different activities, all of which are aimed at making sure that we never know it exists. I'm not quite sure whether that makes sense to your listeners. But when public health is effective, and when public health professionals are effective, we don't know they're there. They're the ones who are responsible for making sure that we don't come down with a disease, that we don't drink polluted water, that we don't breathe air that's bad for us, that we don't go into restaurants and suspect that the food is contaminated. They're the ones who are really watching out over our everyday environment to make sure that we don't come down with a host of different diseases. So it's a field that's made up of scientists and epidemiologists and bacteriologists and even now historians who are interested in figuring out ways of keeping all of us healthy.
Yeah, okay. And we just heard there from...
That was David Rosner.
Okay, very good. David Rosner, thank you very much. And now I want to ask Gerald Markowitz about something that the two of you used to close your introduction to this book, Are We Ready? You quote an official from the CDC, quoting a former CDC official as saying, public health is where politics and science come together. I want to talk a little bit about that idea.
Well, public health really is this intersection of politics and health and science. And perhaps the place you can see that most dramatically was in the response to September 11th in New York City, where public health officials did an extraordinary job to prepare the city for this terrible event. And their initial response was extraordinary. They, there was tons and tons of rotting food in restaurants and delis and supermarkets, and they made sure that there was not a lot of rats who were going to come and get that food and infect residents in the area. They made sure that there was an effort to clear out water that was standing around because they were pouring so much water on the pile. This was West Nile season in New York. And to make sure that the mosquitoes didn't propagate in those pools of water and infect the workers who were there. But public health also was very concerned about the air quality, and we've been hearing a lot in New York, I'm not sure if it's gotten across the country or not, about the air quality in New York and the fact that so many of the people who were working on the pile, so many firefighters and police officers and ordinary citizens have gotten terrible diseases as a result of working on the World Trade Center site. But they, the public health officials, understood that they didn't know initially how dangerous that air was, and they knew that they were getting contrary readings. Some readings were showing the air was safe, and some readings were showing that the air was not safe. And where politics entered in was that where the EPA initially had said that there was some danger to people in that area, unfortunately, the White House stepped in, that is, the politics stepped in, and said, no, you can't say that the air is dangerous. You've got to reassure people that everything is all right, that everything is safe for people to go back to work and people go back to live in the area. So this was a terrible example of where the political system really interfered with the public health judgment and has produced a real tragedy for many, many thousands of people in New York.
Yeah, we have been hearing that story here in this part of the country, by the way, about the risks posed by the dust and debris and the people that were working in that area and the terrible health problems that they have now as a result. You know, at the same time, though, when you tell people you want to, in the immediate aftermath of a disaster, you want to give that message that, you know, we're going to get through this. It's going to be okay. Let's go back to work. Right?
Well, you have to be honest with people. Public health really depends upon the trust of the population to tell, to go to authorities when they're feeling sick or when they're feeling worried or when they suspect something is going on. And people will only do that if they have trust in the public health system. The moment you start giving them false information, then you're really in trouble because sooner or later they're going to stop trusting you. And that's really kind of one of the aftermaths of this whole kind of sad, sad story, which is that public health for years and years and years has been building up trust in communities. It's worked very hard ever since really the AIDS epidemic to make sure that it communicated honestly and that people trusted information that was coming out of it and trusted the directions it would give to people. And when you start telling falsehoods, then you start running into real trouble. You can tell people honestly without panicking them that we just are not quite sure about what's going on. We don't have to tell them, as Todd Whitman did and the Bush administration did and parts of the Giuliani administration did, that the air is safe when we don't really know it's safe. You can tell them, look, we're not sure. You know, you have to make a choice about whether you want to move into your apartments. You have to make a choice that about whether you're going to send kids back to school. You can make a choice about whether you're going to go back to work. But we're not sure that Lower Manhattan is really safe right now. And there was no rush. There was no reason to rush that kind of decision. And in the long run, it would have had a much more salubrious, much better effect on the people in the city if they had really felt that they were getting honest information, even if the honest information was somewhat ambiguous. In the long run, I think, you know, openness and truthfulness is really much more important than just trying to tell everybody the world's back to normal, get back to work, go back to school, move back into your homes, even though we don't really know what's going on.
Is that a lesson that's been learned?
That's a good question. I think Katrina didn't indicate that it was learned very well, if it has been learned. I think public health community's always known that, and since September 11th, they've been worried internally about what's happening to their to their own reputations. They are, in some sense, having Tommy Thompson give announcements about anthrax, or which are clearly political announcements and wrong announcements, or having the mayor give pronouncements about Lower Manhattan that are not quite accurate. And I think they've been worried about it. But I'm not sure the administration's really been worried about it or been aware of it. They certainly didn't seem to be very forthcoming about what they understood about Katrina and the effects of Katrina.
I think one indication that the message has not been learned has the way that the people who worked on the pile view the public response to them. And the expression that they use is that they've gone from being heroes to zeros. That even today, the public officials are not fully acknowledging what they went through, the difficulties that they had in getting treatment, in getting diagnosed, in getting a public recognition of the fact that they are suffering from terrible, terrible diseases that are going to affect them for the rest of their lives.
Mayor Bloomberg just recently said, again, gave this kind of false information to people. When asked whether or not the diseases that an individual was suffering from was linked to their exposures during September 11th, he answered, well, we can't really be sure, therefore we're not going to reimburse them, and they don't deserve benefits of various kinds. And that's, technically true, but epidemiologically wrong. We know that the people, the population, that's the number of people coming down with strange symptoms and terrible lung conditions, are so large in Lower Manhattan that it's not a chance event of an individual who happened to smoke beforehand or happened to have asthma. But this is really, a much more serious condition that's due to their exposures. On an individual level, you can't tell whether any individual is really sick from any particular exposure. But as a population issue, as a public health issue, you know that people are sick. So for him to say, well, we can't really tell whether you're sick, whether you as an individual are sick, is a kind of dishonesty that really, further undermines people's trust of the public health system.
Mm. What's it going to take to rebuild public confidence in public health then?
Well, I think that one of the things that is needed is really a being forthright about the mistakes that were made in the past. And I think another part that is needed is that we've had now 25 years of the bashing of government. Saying that the government's too big, the government is doesn't represent us, the government is the problem, not the solution. And for public health, you really need much more government resources that are going to be supporting a wide variety of personnel and activities. The simple fact is that we don't have enough people who are staffing public health agencies across the country. We don't have people trained in epidemiology. We don't have lab technicians. And until there is really a massive, massive infusion of funds, that won't happen. And, of course, there's not going to be a massive infusion of funds unless there's a commitment to really building up the public health infrastructure all across the country.
One of the issues that came to light with Katrina, of course, is how unprepared we are in many ways, but also how the administration, the Bush administration in particular, has in some sense undermined public health, not only confidence in public health, but also the very infrastructure itself. And of course, we can all remember that he's appointed people since September 11th who aren't really trained, that he's seen the government activities of health and emergency management as basically political political activities, not as professional and not as scientific activities. And that's really kind of a tragedy. I think we all remember heck of a job Brownie. And you know, when he was relieved of his authority, I originally thought that it was he must have been appointed before this whole event of September 11th. And then it became apparent to me that he was appointed afterwards. And it speaks to the way the very political leadership of the country is undermining the very administrations and the very agencies that are essential to the protection of the public by appointing people who are, in the case of FEMA, you know, his major qualification was that Brownie was, head of the Arabian Horsemen's Association or some agency like that. But that they don't have a trust. They themselves don't have a trust in government agencies, don't like government agencies, and have really not done what they should be doing over the last few years to make sure all our government services are really available and effective.
And also maybe one of you could comment on FEMA, the Federal Emergency and Management Agency, being folded into the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, it was one of the issues that came up in the course of our interviews among many of the individuals on the state level who were concerned about disaster response, because they felt that FEMA was an agency that worked very well, that the Clinton administration had really devoted the resources and brought in quality people to really have decent emergency response. And they feared that if FEMA was put under the Department of Homeland Security, that their power and authority would be eroded. And in fact, the very next year after it was incorporated into Department of Homeland Security, its budget was cut. The morale of the staff was sank, and there was this tremendous feeling that they were not being given the resources, they were not being given the respect, they were not being given the opportunity to plan and to put those plans into operation that was necessary for them to be able to do a decent job. And of course, what happened, the tragedy of Katrina, was a terrible testament to what had actually happened.
One other thing about the CDC, I don't know if you know about this, but five of the former CDC directors, administrators, head administrators, signed a letter yesterday because of their concerns that the CDC itself was in such low morale. The Centers for Disease Control, which is, of course, our prime federal agency, and there are all sorts of things that are going on about that, but that five former administrators are worried enough about what's happened to the CDC to protest certain changes and certain initiatives is a really telling problem. They're worried in part that the scientific goals and the technical goals and the service goals of that agency are being undermined somehow, and it's going to be interesting over the next few months to find out what they think is going on and why that's happening.
Yeah, any guesses? You want to go out on a limb there?
Well, I think one of the things that's happened is that the CDC has been forced to focus more and more on bioterrorism per se, and to focus on the military response to bioterrorism. And this is a real dilemma for the CDC and for public health, because the military's initial response and often long-term response to any disaster or problem or issue is to close down information, to keep things secret, and to fear information getting out. And as David had indicated earlier, the CDC and public health in general depends upon openness of information. They really depend upon having a greater flow of information rather than a lesser flow of information, because if you have a greater flow of information, if you have more people knowing about an issue, then you're going to get more input and more ways of dealing with a problem and more knowledge about what that problem is. So this is a big dilemma for the CDC, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out in the future.
Mm. We interviewed many people, both at the CDC, at the state, and the local level, and one of the universal themes that came out was that public health, in order to prepare for bioterrorist attacks, a biological release of anthrax or smallpox or anything else, you need exactly the same kinds of infrastructure as you need for following SARS, for avian flu, for any of the infectious diseases. So you can't just prepare for one without really being prepared for all. And what their universal call for was for more revamping and strengthening of the public health infrastructure, the labs, the personnel, the things that the communication systems, the reporting systems, the surveillance systems, all of which require, you know, really a building up of the same kinds of services that you would use to keep people healthy and to protect against infectious disease in general as you would need for any kind of bioterrorist attack. And so their call was for revamping and strengthening the public health infrastructure. The administration's interests are really much more focused. And this isn't to say that all public health has not made any improvements over the last 4 years, but that their focus is much more on the immediate bioterrorist attack. And the simple issue is you can't really prepare for one without preparing for the other. And that requires kind of an attention to the entire system.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, David Rosner and Gerald Markowitz, they are both historians. They are the authors, co-authors of numerous articles and books, including Are We Ready? Public Health Since 9/11. That our topic this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now, joining us from Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hello. I was very interested in your earlier comments about the aftermath of 9/11, and I'm sure that you're right that the ball was dropped on the safety predictions that were made and so on. But I wonder if it isn't true that if you use the word Lower Manhattan, that you have to make some fine distinctions between people who were working in the rubble of the World Trade Tower and the people a quarter of a mile away who might have a white-collar job down on Wall Street. Say that the person over at 40 Wall Street, let's say, is not working in safe conditions would be one thing, and to say it about somebody who was working in the rubble is something quite different. So I don't think you make a blanket statement about the safety of the air in Lower Manhattan.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that you can't do that, and that was part of the problem with what Christy Todd Whitman did, was that her statement was very ambiguous and ended up reassuring people who lived in the area when she now claims that isn't what she meant. But if you listen to what she actually says, she doesn't say people on the pile should wear protective equipment, but people in the surrounding area, just have to clean up their houses. She really says that the area is safe, and that was simply one, not true, because they did testing not only on the pile but also in the surrounding area, and they were finding excess amounts of asbestos and other contaminants in the area around Ground Zero that were in neighborhoods that people lived as well as where people worked.
One of the things that you have to remember is that if you lived in Manhattan during that whole period of time, literally the weeks after September 11th, for weeks, if not months, I remember on New Year's Day, you could still smell the stench. Anywhere in lower Manhattan, you could smell it for months. You knew that you had a rancid commingling of smells from burning plastics and from, you know, the pile burned continually for literally weeks and weeks and weeks. Burning plastics of pulverized glass, of concrete, of manganese and cadmium and lead and all sorts of heavy metals from lamps and from fluorescent bulbs and mercury. You had a stew of toxic materials that people knew smelled. And so when Christy Whitman and even Giuliani said the air was safe, for anyone in that area, you knew that their definition of safety was completely different than anyone you could, any common sense definition. We knew that when we were sending kids back to school, that air stunk and that the cleanups were done very haphazardly. They weren't done by the EPA. They were done by local contractors and individuals and sometimes undocumented workers who were literally pulled off the street in the morning to clean up different apartment buildings and even office buildings around the area. So there was no way of her knowing that what was going on in the buildings was any different than what was going on with the pile. And there also was a common sense that all of us who are living there know that something is wrong, and yet we're being told that we can move back downtown, that our kids could go back into the local schools 3 blocks away from the burning pile, that we could go and repopulate office buildings, that we can use the parks, when in fact we all saw the dust that was lying around, and anyone who went to a parent meeting at a school could smell it. They knew their kids were coming back with coughs, and yet they were getting reassurances from the government, constant reassurances that no matter what you smell, whatever your senses tell you, it's don't worry about it. And that was a very ambiguous message that really shouldn't have been given out, because it led to, really lots of people moving back. And today, lots of individuals really worried about their health, even if they didn't work on top of the pile.
I hope that answers the listener's question. Let's go and take another call, a listener in Champaign, line 2. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and I want to commend the speakers for being very moderate and careful in their speech. So the question I pose, I want to be as careful. Could you discuss some of the larger public health concerns that maybe deal with issues of just general pollution? Here in Illinois, we're very coal positive, but I know coal is actually a very dirty fuel, as is gasoline. And I feel that the EPA perhaps is not able to speak as much as it would to the levels of certain toxics, and especially in inner cities with gasoline or other products in the industry. I'm just curious about that. How's the epidemiology of that looking right now? And thank you.
Well, Jerry, do you want to answer that? Or
go ahead.
Again, we can't really talk about the specifics of Illinois. We don't know, and we're hoping that the EPA is being very forthright about information regarding toxics in the air. But again, the listeners, I think implicit in the caller's question is a suspicion, and that is really so sad for us as historians of this whole episode, a suspicion of what the EPA is doing, whether or not it's being honest with us. And that's the that's kind of a lasting legacy. That's a lasting legacy of, a sense that, the government is not really being forthright. And if we trusted the EPA, we'd say, well, that air is good. Or we'd know, we would be able to say whether or not we believe that information. And so I almost find, as a historian, the question itself is an indication of exactly what we're talking about, which is, can we really tell? And can we believe our public officials, and can we be sure that they're not just trying to represent some narrow interest or to make sure a coal company continues to sell its coal or the other kinds of questions that begin to immediately crop up in our minds that may not have cropped up 30 years ago or 20 years ago, before the kind of onslaught on government and onslaught of, the election of officials who don't believe in the very government agencies that they're supposed to build and create.
You know, the only thing I would add to that is that certainly we know that over the past several years, the enforcement of environmental and occupational health concerns and firms are way down. And that is a problem that concerns a lot of people. And it goes back to September 11th in the sense that there were many people who worked on the pile at the World Trade Center site, and many of them did not wear respirators. Instead of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration requiring anybody who worked at the World Trade Center site to wear a respirator so that they would be safe, they simply dropped the ball. And it was a very different situation at the Pentagon. No one at the Pentagon was allowed to work in that rubble and work in that area unless they had full respiratory protection. And the government really did not fulfill its obligation to protect its citizens by not insisting that the same thing happen at the World Trade Center site.
I'm sorry.
There was just such a rush to get New York, quote, back to normal, to act like everything was fine, that all sorts of safety precautions were kind of avoided and ignored.
When the anthrax attacks happened, what kind of grade would you give the government in terms of responding to that and getting information out to the public?
Well, one of the interesting things about the anthrax attacks happened, I guess, 4 weeks after.
Yeah, September 25th, I think, was the first.
3 weeks after.
A couple
weeks after, and you almost see a disintegration in the response between September 11th itself and the anthrax attacks. When the one thing we want to make people remember is that the initial response of the public health authorities was quite phenomenal when the buildings were hit. I was looking for my daughter, who was at a local school near there, and I was in a frantic rush up and down 11th and 12th Avenues, going down, looking at 300,000 faces streaming out of Lower Manhattan, trying to find my daughter, who was also walking home from school, or getting home from school. And I saw it like this astounding array of services that were suddenly available. There were ambulances lining the West Side Drive, the river, waiting to go down to collect victims or help down there. There was in every corner people giving out water bottles from the health department. There were masks being given out for free. There were professionals who were lining the area trying to, in some sense, soothe frayed nerves as people came out of there. You saw many people, just nurses and doctors. You saw the hospitals emptying out and literally getting ready for mass casualties. In some sense, it was an extraordinary sign of how the New York City public health infrastructure was there and ready to go and very, very involved. Yet by the time the anthrax attack happened, you started seeing a fraying of all the public trust and also the activities of the health department. They were overwhelmed by anthrax. The labs they had, and New York City has an enormous number of labs, were completely flooded by samples from all sorts of areas of all sorts of dusts that people suspected were anthrax. They had gotten so many false messages from the government that anything could be anthrax that lots of things came in that had no resemblance to it. The area that the labs themselves were actually polluted. They opened envelopes without knowing how to do it. They weren't prepared to do that in such a mass scale. They were such careful scientists. But one of the messages came out of that was that you really have to have proper facilities available. Even New York didn't. You have to have trained people who know how to do these things and also enough facilities to really make sure that you can do these things. You can do the lab tests. So the anthrax episode was kind of the beginnings of a sign that there was a real problem with the infrastructure that led public health people throughout the country to say, look, we have to get ready. We have to get our labs ready. We have to be ready. And so it was the beginning of a kind of concerted effort on the public health people's part, on the professionals' part, to say this is how we do it. We do it by getting our labs ready. We get our personnel ready, and we continue from there. So
you know, the other major issue with anthrax was the difference in the response between the federal government and New York City. The federal government, instead of letting the Surgeon General or the director of the administrator of the CDC speak to the issues of anthrax and speak from a scientific basis and tell people exactly what was known and not known, instead of that, they had Tommy Thompson be the point person on all anthrax information, and he was giving out wildly inaccurate information and causing greater concern and greater worry than was necessary. Whereas in New York City, although Rudolph Giuliani was sometimes the spokesperson, he really took his cues from the public health people. And the major message in New York City was an admission of what we knew and what we didn't know. And people really were able to deal with what the public health officials didn't know, and because they knew that they were being honest with them. And that made a big difference in the response in New York to that.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. Moving from anthrax to AIDS, one thing I've noticed is that we hear so much about medications to treat AIDS, lots and lots and lots of information about that, and a lot of push for that. What I don't hear is that when people are treated, they're not cured. And I guess people, there must be some assumption that they will be celibate or practice protection, but that's almost a joke. A few would, but not that many. Yet that seems to be like a well-kept secret. You just don't hear about that. So, in fact, what we're doing by treating people with AIDS is spreading the epidemic more, right? They stay alive longer.
I'm sorry. What were you saying?
They stay alive, and they look well and healthy, but they're, you know, able to spread the disease.
I'm not sure what you're suggesting. It's a kind of a humane and important response that people get treated. This isn't really what we're expert in, but certainly we would hope that we as a society would, you know, be humane about making sure that people had adequate medications. And the AIDS epidemic has been, you know, a tragedy that affects all of us. And we have, you know, been, I think the antiretrovirals have been extremely important in prolonging and making a huge difference in people's lives.
Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago on line four. Hi.
Yeah, the unfortunate circumstances of 9/11 and Katrina and other geophysical disasters that occur throughout the world are evident of our lack of ability to deal with the aftermath. But prevention is worse upon the cure, at least that's what I heard a long time ago. And at the advent of the atomic age, before they went ahead and built the nuclear reactors, they were cautioned about the dealing with the matter of the waste product and how to handle that, let alone the structural engineering and safety of the nuclear facilities. We've barely dealt with the atomic waste and other structural matters to the point where we can really regard them as safe, and to say nothing of dealing with the aftermath of an atomic explosion. that was unfortunately at least upon Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But we certainly see unless certain matters impinge the military-industrial complex, I don't see your ability to get funds for maintaining the CDC and other necessary organizations forthcoming, because apparently the military-industrial complex gets the brunt of all the funding.
Okay.
Well, yes, I mean, I think that a major problem with the response up to now is it's been the narrow focus on the military aspects of these issues and not dealing with what David indicated was the importance of developing public health infrastructure in general so that you could deal with public health of the society as a whole, as well as with bioterrorism.
Yeah, and that brings me to ask this question. Now, speaking of funding, you know, at the state level, lots of states, including this one, the state of Illinois, face large budget deficits. To what extent do state budget deficits affect the ability of states to respond to a disaster?
Well, that's one of the tragedies of the whole federal initiative. In some sense, we've poured so many resources into the Iraq War that the attempt to revamp and protect the nation as a whole internally have, in some sense, been sacrificed. The $4 billion that have gone to revamping public health often are, when they were first announced, when they have been delivered to the states, they actually end up being supplements to budget deficits that that exist at the state level. And that's one of the things we found when we were interviewing state officials, that when states went into the recession shortly after September 11th and their budget deficits ballooned, when the money came in from the federal government, it was used in some sense to replace the money that was being taken away at the state level. And that was a really kind of bad byproduct of the whole event, that we are, you know, we were in a recession, budget deficits did explode, and states ended up finding the federal money being in some sense a replacement for what had previously existed, so it was kind of a zero-sum game.
Yeah. We've got to wrap up here fairly quickly. I want to ask one more question, though. In the wake of September 11th, we've seen changes in the role of the National Guard. The Guard's been deployed to fight wars. What does that mean for a state's ability to respond to a crisis? And maybe a quick comment on the impact that had along the Gulf Coast, in particular, the state of Louisiana, in preparing for and in the aftermath of Katrina.
Well, I think that you're absolutely right, that and it's something that state officials have been complaining about for quite some time, is that if you're going to take National Guard units and put them in Iraq, and National Guard units have been the mainstay of the response to disasters in state after state after state, then the states are not going to be able to deal with the difficulties that they're faced with in minor disasters or in major disasters. And, you know, there was a tremendous test after September 11th of this question that we raise in our book, Are We Ready? And that test was Katrina. And on every level, whether it be the social service area or public health or medicine or just government being responsive to its citizens, that was a tremendous, terrible human failure on many, many levels.
Yeah, and also here's something also that might be worth talking about at another time, but the physical infrastructure in New Orleans was so critical. And so we can look at physical infrastructure, the levees, as an issue, as a public health issue.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. That's it. I mean, public health is not just isolatable to a set of activities that happen in a laboratory there. Really, very broad-based activities that require the attention of that are part of a much larger social response to need and to
disease-causing situations. And of course, the levees and the preparedness and making sure there's food available and that there are shelters for people are all really very, very much part of an appropriate public health response.
Okay. There we have to leave it. David Rosner, Gerald Markowitz, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Our guests this afternoon are historians. They are the co-authors of many articles and books, including the one we've been talking about this afternoon, Are We Ready? Public Health Since 9/11, the book published by the University of California Press.